When we think about security and how do we secure the environment within an organization, the topic nearly always kind of starts with, what should I do with firewalls and networks and privileged access and servers and all this infrastructure related stuff? And maybe I'll get to the client and it'll probably be an antivirus, like some kind of antivirus that maybe I'll patch, right? That's kind of where we start. And we really think about the SQL, someone dumping the SQL server, getting access to the whole environment. And we're right to think about those things, absolutely. But sometimes the client itself is the asset the adversary is after. Let me give you an example of some of the things that we've seen from customers who had an adversary going after them. This case, right, we had a customer where the adversary had compromised via a weak password scheme, a weak password on a single endpoint. Interestingly, that endpoint wasn't even a Windows endpoint. It was just a bad password on the guy's email account that he accessed through his iPad. So he got access to the email stream. And you gotta think about, well, how valuable is an email stream to an adversary? And it's like, oh, well, that email stream, you send out a lot of potentially interesting things, such as the CFO sending out a notice saying, hey, here's our results. Now I know the CFO's name and email address. And the IT department with their helpful, hey, this project is coming. You're going to have to do this on about this day. Now I know projects. Now I know the IT department. I know people who are there listening to. And what they did was they sent a mail directly to the CFO because that was the asset they wanted. They didn't need domain admin. They didn't need a SQL server. They wanted the CFO's device. Sent an email from the IT department, quote unquote, telling them we're moving you up a week. Go ahead and click on this now, pointing to what they were going to do to exploit that one system. Right, there's some kind of dirty stuff going on here, right? That kind of stuff happens. Sometimes you have high-value assets on the client. So what we want to talk about here is, what is the best plan that we've come up with so far to help really protect endpoints? How do we keep moving forward? Because we still want to do all the rest of the work. It all fits in, but I want to make sure I'm protecting the client. Because the challenge we run into, right, stuff happens really quick. If someone sends an email to 100 people, 23 of them statistically are going to open it. 11 will open the attachment. And 6 of them will do it within the first hour. So we've got to figure out, how do we defend a lot of endpoints in an environment like that? In an environment where it's not just information theft, sometimes it's ransomware. Sometimes it's, you know, just capturing information. What can we do to defend that? And when I really think about putting together a holistic security strategy, there are really two different broad categories of adversaries as I see them. Now, there's a kind of a third one that I think of now, right? But one broad category is the adversary who's trying to capture everything. He's going to try and pop an initial endpoint device, start moving around, wait till they get to main admin, go up, capture that, and then boom, own the entire environment, and now I can do whatever I want to, right? So that's pretty well known. We've been talking about that for a while, past the hash and things like that, and protecting their most sensitive hashes there. But what about the adversary that's trying to go after a specific high-value asset, like the CFO? Or like the case when we were working with a customer that was trying to protect some really privileged scientific information, research they were doing on a new product. And what the adversary had done was they figured out, hey, there's a conference coming out that this team is likely to want to go to. And they're about the only company in the state that would do that. So they made a Facebook page. Attendees of this conference from this state. And they put in an exploit that they didn't happen to be patched for. And 3 of them followed that and joined that Facebook page. They're going after specific information in many cases. So I want to think about that and build out a framework that we can help protect against that. This framework fits into a holistic framework of how we at Microsoft think about security. So you may have seen this slide already. And when I look at where does this fit, this is the devices pillar. We want to make sure the endpoint devices are as secure as possible. So when we talk about building out, we'd say, yeah, there's a lot of fundamental stuff. We want to try and get everyone all on the same page in terms of the fundamentals. and then get into the second phase where we really start building out what we can do in each tier. In this case, we're talking about devices. So what is the framework that I think about? And for me, it's one that is very secular. We don't want to boil the ocean and say we have to do all of these for every single thing, because then we tend to never get done. We get paralysis. We need to think of more agile ways to go about doing it. So when we think about the framework, it all starts with number one, right? And I am passionate about this. All of the other things you do kind of don't matter if your users are all admins. There we go. How many of you still have at least 10% of your users still members of local admins? At least 50%. At least 100%. And there are still hands up for those who aren't in the room. So we start here. It's really, really important to me. Making users standard users and proper standard users. And there's a couple of gateways to get there. The first one is I have to fix all of my crap that broke. Because that's why I keep it, right? There's few people who say, well, oh, I like having admins everywhere, right? People don't like being admin. They like not being inconvenienced. Right? We've got to root cause it. As long as we're not inconveniencing people, they kind of don't care. Right? I'm not root on my phone, and I don't care because it works for everything I need to do. So fixing my stuff so I can do my work, very important. But then if they're not the admin, I need to be the admin. Right? So if I'm not packaging and deploying everything in a timely manner, that's a problem. Incidentally, that's the challenge we see with what I find to be the hardest audience to get to standard users, the audience of the developer. Developers are a pain in the butt. And I say that as a developer, right? Is that this is sort of where we start with, but it's because developers tend to find software that really does help them accelerate their ability to deliver great software on short timelines. That's what we're charging them to do. And that's the kind of software that tends to update once every, sometimes a couple days. So how do we give them the ability to get that? Do we have packaging that works quickly enough that I don't have to make them double-click themselves? So I need to figure out how to package, how to service, and get that up to date. And a lot of that comes from really starting to cultivate what's going on in my application portfolio, keeping it managed and keeping it easy so that that becomes a doable task. But let's talk about the first one, because that's usually the obstacle. My stuff doesn't work. And there's a solution out there that there's several software companies that are happy to help you with, where we'll just say, you know what, we'll take you out of the local administrators group and we'll just put these particular pieces of software into that group. Now, I tend to be pretty pragmatic. I think there are scenarios where that makes sense. But I don't like to start with that, and here's why. Right? As a person, you never are personally an admin. It's always the software you run that's running as administrator. Right? So start with all of your software running as admin, and you go to less of your software running as admin. Right? And then you're like, oh, that's better. But think about the choice you made. Rather than having it be all of my software running as admin, now I only have my oldest and worst software running as admin. Hold on. That's probably not moving as far forward as I thought it was when I took a look at that. So I like to start with, can I go in and fix some stuff? And it turns out that you can. There's a very specialized skill, but I'm going to show you that skill and give you a sense of how that works, because we can fix a lot of applications. Now, how many of you have been to any of my app compat talks from back in the Windows 7 days? All right, so a little bit of this will be kind of a go up to the Wayback Machine, because we're kind of presenting this to a new audience now, the security audience, trying to unwind this. Because it's not only that, hey, we're giving old software, untrustworthy software, our ultimate trust. There's also the fact that, hey, it turns out to be difficult to unwind a lot of those configurations. I would love to bring in the ability to start fixing applications. So let's take a look at that. This will be kind of a refresher for those who've been here and new for those who are there. I want you to see the power of the platform we have for getting rid of admin rights without just giving it to a subset of your software. So we're going to start with our trusty friend Stock Viewer, which is an application that is posted up on my blog, so you can go to appcompatguy.com or look for Stock Viewer Shim Demo. And you can download this and run it yourself. It does absolutely nothing worthwhile except break, so it's a lot like most of the software we run internally. And the first thing we notice is it says, hey, you've got to be an admin to run the application, right? And this is really, really common. There's actually quite a few things that we fix by default, going all the way back to Vista, that just is fixed in the platform itself without you even having to worry about it. You know, one feature that's part of UAC, so number one, turn on UAC. Number two, no, really turn on UAC. It's very, very important. UAC is a suite of technologies that fixes software and gives you additional security platforms. UAC has never broken an application. That is a misnomer. Running a standard user breaks applications. UAC just fails to fix all of them. But it fixes some of them. For example, part of UAC is file and registry virtualization. If you try to write to program files, we'll automatically redirect it to a per user location. You don't have to do anything. It just happens. It's like magic. Now, you've changed the semantics. It went from a per machine write to a per user write, but in single user machines, there's literally no difference. In multi-user machines, you know, potentially that causes some problems, but at least it didn't break. So a lot of times this check is legacy from XP. Hey, I couldn't write here. Let me go ahead and throw up a warning. It may already be fixed. So we have a fix that lets us get past that. That fix is called force admin access, which when you hear that, it sounds like you're actually going to force it to have administrator access. Whoop. Right, doesn't it? If you read the name of that, what would you think it did? Just gave it admin. Yeah, that's not actually what it does, right? All it does is it pretends to be there. I'm going to show you a snippet of actual source code from Windows for this shim. One of the APIs we intercept is we intercept the isUserAndAdmin API. And here's what the code in the shim does. IsUserAndAdmin? Yep. Right, it kind of addresses one of the questions that comes up, which is, all right, shims, I'm actually running different code I'm intercepting. Is there a performance trade-off? And in this case, yes. We've gone from, I have to actually crack open your token, rifle through, look for this admin token, see if it's there, and if so, say yes, to immediately, yes, an O of one operation. Doesn't matter how big your token is, immediately, yeah, you're an admin. Everything's cool. Very easy. So we apply that, and that's going to go away. It's a good one to have handy because it gets you past quite a lot. So if I go in, we're going to make a new application fix for Stock Viewer. It's by me. I got to be proud. Program files, Stock Viewer, stockviewer.exe. And I'm going to use force admin access. Now, for those of you who watched this from back in the Windows 7 days, I'm going to have to show you one little extra bit of configuration option about shims, which is particular to the fact that this is running on top of the .NET framework. So before I begin, how many of you have no idea what a shim is? All right, so quite a few people. So the shim infrastructure is something we put in place in Windows 2000. Really didn't use it for much. We used it a fair amount in Windows XP to get a lot of the 95, 98 applications working. What we do is we'll intercept the API for Windows and replace it with an alternate behavior, but in a way that's targeted at the app. So the way we used to have to do it back in like Windows 3.1 is there would literally be a branch in the code that would say, if you are this app, run this code, else run that code. Right, but there's a challenge with that, right? Number one, 15 years later, for the code that sticks around, we're like, all right, first of all, does Lotus 1-2-3 matter anymore? Right, because that's in our source code, it's baked in, right? That becomes a problem. Number two, if you want to add another shim for another app, you've got to get the source code of Windows and recompile it. Turns out we don't give it to you, right? So that's a problem. So shims abstract it. We just say this API replace with this alternate interpretation, and I can do it in a way that's targeted at the app. So we're going to start by targeting at the stockviewer.exe app, and all of our fixes will apply to nothing else on the system. When you call this API, this thing happens differently. And we're going to call force admin access. It happens to be managed code. And I'll just say this for people who actually want to be practitioners. You know, we'll skip through it in the rest. When I click on the parameters, I do need to add a couple of additional modules, mscorewks.dll and clr.dll, because it's generated managed code. Right? And the reason why you didn't have to on Windows 7 is because we fixed a bug. So in the shim infrastructure, we have a global exclude, is what it's called. So we, by default, won't shim things that are in system 32. We won't shim things that are in different parts of the Windows directory. And we had put in there, don't shim the .NET framework. And that code actually didn't work on Windows 7. We fixed the bug, and it started working, and we began excluding the .NET framework. So stuff you may have shimmed will stop being shimmed, and that's how you get it back to being shimmed. So far, so good? I know we're kind of, for people who are new to shims, right, we're kind of careening through it, right? So feel free to slow me down if you have anything you want to see. All we're doing is saying, I want to fix this and pretend to be an admin. And so let me go ahead and save it, and I'll call this Ignite. Stick this on the desktop. Ignite.sdb. Now I have a shim database file that's sitting local to my machine. I'm going to install it now, because it's just a database. It's not doing anything. Now it's installed. And installation, right, is the actual process to do it. There's a command line variable that sits in system 32, so it's probably in your path, called sdbinst.exe, sdb install. And that's all right-click install did. It was called that. And now it's installed locally. Now, every single time I go to launch an executable, it's going to check against not only the database that's built in, because we're already doing this. We have 5,616 applications we're already fixing for you using this approach in Windows 10, current build. I'm in the fast ring build that came to me yesterday, conveniently right in the middle of my presentation. Fortunately, it didn't reboot, right? So all worked well. But we use this all the time. And you're just using the same thing we do. We've registered it. When the create process gets called, actually, for super nerds, right, create process internal W is the actual API that calls into shimeng.dll. You can see it getting loaded. Watch it in procmon. And then we'll actually go in and check and say, oh, you match. We're going to start fixing you. Because we're looking for that match, it happens when the process gets launched. So we do need to close it. The next time we launch it, the shim will be applied. Just made the error go away. And now we can wash, rinse, repeat, right? This is the process. I'm going to fix the application. So let's look at a couple of other things that are broken. And what I want to focus on is the stuff that we actually find in the wild. And that's been the focus, right? When we look at the actual shims that are available, there are 412 of what we call, you know, reusable shims in the system shim database. There are a lot more. If you want to see the rest of them, you can launch Compatibility Administrator, which is part of the Application Compatibility Toolkit, which is part of the Windows ADK, and launch Compatibility Administrator with the super secret undocumented /X command line switch, and you can see the rest of them, right? Not that helpful. There's like one of them's called Frogger. Guess what it does? It fixes the game Frogger. Probably not useful to your app. These ones are likely to be useful. So we got 412 fixes, but it turns out you really don't need to know 412 things. So we have documentation on what they are. I usually do a search for correct file paths, which we'll look at later. Ooh, look at that. All right, here's the documentation. And if we look at it here, like we've got the list of all the shims that are on there. Using the blah, blah, blah shim gives all kinds of details, right? For super nerds, here are all of the APIs we're intercepting, the behavior, all the information you want, how to configure it, and so forth. I document about 30 out of hundreds because I'm like, you know what? I don't use any other ones. So these are just the ones I actually use. And that's what we're going to focus on, things that actually we see actually happening in production. So I'm going to also introduce to you the tool that I like to use to get it done. Now, I personally can probably debug a lot of these things by eyeball. just because I've been doing this since 2006. Let's hope I at least learn a few things by now, right? But most normal humans, and I certainly don't qualify myself amongst that group, aren't going to want to have to figure out how to do these things by eye. They want to have something help them. There's a free tool called Lua Bug Light. Lua Bug Light. A tool written by my friend Aaron Margosis, who's also speaking here. He may have already been. He's probably sysinternals. But 2.3 is the current version, and it's just given away. You can go download it right off his blog. So go to the bottom. Here's the zip file. You can grab it, and it's just a single exe inside of the zip file. And it's what I use to do some checks. So I'm going to point it at Stock Viewer and start it. Actually, I'm going to close this one so I don't get confused. Now try it. And now I've got the application running. Now what's interesting, let me describe the approach and what Lua Bug Light is actually doing. It's a beautiful, elegant approach. It actually generates two tokens, a standard user token and an administrator token. And it runs everything using the standard user token first, right? Try this operation, and it handles all of the errors that come back. And if you get an error, try the other one. The standard user one worked, but the admin didn't work, but the admin one did. That's probably a bug with not having admin rights. Because I just tried it both ways and observed a difference. If this one didn't work and this one didn't work, nothing's flagged. If they both work, nothing's flagged. It's just when this one doesn't, this one does. So we get really, really high accuracy on the issues. So I'm going to go ahead and try a couple things. Like, actually, you know what? Before I do that, let me show you the bugs so that you know that there's not smoke and mirrors. So one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to go to Tools, Options, and I'm going to see, oh, it's giving me an error. All right, and I'm going to go to Help, Check for Updates. Oh, another error. Let me go and click on the Trends button. Ah, another error. I made a comment in my session yesterday that error messages tend to not be helpful. I added the line in the middle. But the rest of it, I literally copied and pasted from an actual application I was troubleshooting. And I'm like, really, what are those things? And why did you show them to me? Error messages are not always helpful, believe it or not. So a couple of things don't work. Now let's try them with Bug Light. So what's going to do is I'm going to go to Tools, Options. Oh, okay, that works, right? Help, Check for Updates. Okay, well, that's working, great. And then I'll go to the Trends button. Let go. Oh, great. Everything's working now. I just watched it all work. And when I say stop, it's going to show me what happened. All right, here's an overall summary of what I did, what I ran, when I ran it. And it's going to say, oh, here's a problem. You're trying to create something in this registry key. And I can go and see all kinds of excruciating details on it, right? Here's the stack for it. You know, all the distinct call stacks, so only one bit of code called it. I can see all the differences. Here's the actual operations, right? Lots and lots of details if I'm trying to troubleshoot. Great if I'm a developer. I can look at other objects that are being created. I can look at, hey, this needs elevation. But what I want to convert that to is, how would I fix it? So the first one, this registry one, I'm trying to write to HKEY classes root. Now, a little bit of registry refresh, right? A lot of people don't think about the registry that much anymore. HKEY classes root doesn't actually exist. HKEY classes root is a virtual registry key that is a merge of HKEY local machine / software / classes and HKEY current user / software / classes. And interestingly, if you try to read them, we'll try user first and go to machine second. But if you try to write to it, we'll try machine first and user second. And the machine one will fail if you're not an admin. Right, so, okay, now I know what's happening. HKEY classes root, and it's trying to write to it, create it, doesn't exist. Right, and sort of the other interesting thing about this one, why I talk at great length about it, is it turns out if you go and find yourself a copy of Visual Studio 6, make a brand new C++ project, check the checkbox saying make it an ActiveX executable, and finish the wizard and write no code of your own, we will inject this Lua bug into your code for you. You're welcome. So there's a fair bit in there. So it's good to know how to fix this one, right? So let's go through and get them fixed. I'll go back into Stock Viewer, and I can just right-click, edit the fix, and I'm going to add more, right? So for that one, it's even going to, in bug light, suggest to me, hey, try that one. Virtualize HKCR Lite. Fast and easy way to go and fix an application. Right, so let's do that one. So virtualize HKCR Lite. We'll get that one applied. We've got to go through and do our mscrwks.dll and clr.dll. Sorry, this is so boring, but we'll get past that stuff. All right, what's the next one we want to fix? Well, let's go back to bug light. Oh, it's trying to create a global file mapping object, right? Oh, that's not granted, right? It turns out this one does have a fix, which is the local mapped object fixed. So I can apply that one. Bug light didn't help me. I had to look that one up, right? But I can still figure it out. mscrwks.dll and clr.dll and okay. And last but not least, error elevation required. Okay, great. Well, we'll go ahead and fix that, which is the elevate create process. Let me explain this one to you, right? So elevation, right, the prompt, what most people think of as being the extent of UAC, elevation is something that happens when we detect that you need to be elevated, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. The process of elevation requires a lot of prerequisites. I have to have a window manager, because I'm going to show you a window. I have to have a services infrastructure, because it's running as a service, and the service calls, you know, consent.exe to show you the box, and there's lots of dependencies, right? Is it possible that you would create a process without having a window manager? Is there any version of Windows that may not have a window manager? Turns out we have an entire shipping SKU, a couple of them now, that don't have a window manager, so elevation wouldn't run on them. So create process still needs to work. But we have this dependency, right? Because we've refactored Windows into a series of layers. So this is just, hey, you used create process versus shell execute. It used to be equivalent. Now, not so much. This is one of the differences between the two. This will just catch that error and retry with the request for elevation. Well, again, mscrwks.dll and clr.dll. So I'm going to go ahead and apply all of these. Save it. Right-click install. And now, the next time I run it, they'll now be fixed without having to have admin rights. And I can do all of this. Now, this is still going to have a bug in it, right? It has a bug that at one point, you know, every single bug that's in Stock Viewer comes from a real application. This one I'm not going to bother showing you how to fix because literally I found it in exactly one application in the entire history of time. That application, incidentally, was ICQ. Original versions of ICQ were running. They were actually trying to capture messages coming from Internet Explorer. Not ICQ, AOL. The AOL dialer, right, which I'm sure most of you use, right, because it's the fastest way online. The AOL dialer would hook into Internet Explorer and wait for a message to come up, but Internet Explorer was running with low trust, so the message was being blocked, so we had to open it up. You can do that. It's possible. We can just say, hey, I'm going to let this one message come through, but none of the rest. And if you don't compile it that way, we can poke a hole and get that happen through shims. But since AOL 9, I've not seen it, so I don't bother to show it to you. But trust me, we can fix that really easily. We've now removed the need for admin rights. There's a couple more things I want to show you. Click on orders, and you'll notice I'm getting a prompt. Right, so when I'm thinking about removing admin rights, a thing to keep in mind is every time I see a prompt, I should think that's a failure. Prompt equals failure. The question becomes, why do I need a prompt? Because a lot of people, let's do take a poll. How many of you, by round of applause, believe that we actually check to see whether you need admin rights in order to show you a prompt? How many of you think that's how we do it? Few people do, right? We don't check to see, right? Because it's really difficult to know what needs admin rights. Any file right, any registry right could arbitrarily need. We have no idea. So how do we figure out what to do? And it turns out there are exactly three sets of rules that we process to determine whether you should see a prompt. Those three are, number one, the developer asked for it. The developer can jack in a little bit of XML that says, I need to be elevated, elevate me, please. So the developer asked for it, number one. Number two, the IT pro asked for it using this exact same mechanism. So the IT pro could go in and apply the run as admin shim and get it running as admin. Developer asked for it, I asked for it, or the third bit, which is what tends to get you, right? And let me explain how we got to the third bit. Where it came from is we track every single day with every build of Windows the application compatibility and compare it across everything else. So every single day we're starting on the trail to Vista, right? Heading towards, you know, beta one, couple restarts on the way, long and jaded history, but still we every day we're running those tests. We get to the beta one release, we ship it. The next day is the first of the beta two builds. So we're tracking, I think the day we ship beta one, we're about 97%. It's pretty good. The next day, we turned on UAC by default, and it went from 97% to 20%. So 4 out of 5 pieces of software broke, and we said, that's not good. I don't think we can ship that. So let's figure out why. And the big thing we saw is, oh, everything, you know, this is back in the days when Install Shield still ruled the world and you didn't actually have as many MSIs, right? Because not as many had, you know, hadn't quite gained complete adoption across everywhere, certainly in a lot of commercial software, and none of it would install. Because what do installers do? Well, everything that exists does not have that little bit of XML. We don't want to have to go and specifically tag every single installer in the world because there's millions of them. So we had to figure out, let's build some heuristics to find the installers, because the problem is they just flat out weren't installing because they write the program files, fail, and the app never actually landed on the box. That caused that precipitous decline. So we said, let's try and find all of those setups heuristically. Now, the heuristics, it turns out, may not be the world's most sophisticated heuristics. Here's our setup heuristic. We look for the word setup. Oh, you might be a setup. Oh, okay, that makes sense. Or seto appu. Think I'm making that up. That's actually full width and half width katakana. So the setup update. Oh, look what we do. Ah, the name is update. Okay, makes sense. Let me scroll back to the top. Install, I-N-S-T-A-L, and patch is the other one. I'll kind of pause on this one, because this is the one that I see catching stuff most often. Update and install show up in a lot of words. All right, and if we match on this, we'll prompt. Unless the developer put in a bit of XML saying, please don't prompt, or the admin puts in a little configuration saying, please don't prompt for this one. That's what we have to do. So we're looking for this heuristic. One of the interesting stories is I was having a conversation with a company called Flexera, right? And a good friend of mine actually lives in my neighborhood, and we actually discovered that a couple years ago, and we started going and hanging out. But we originally met talking about how they're like, everything prompts. Why are you guys prompting on everything? What's going on? And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. The name of a company within your group is Install Shield Incorporated that all has that name in it, so 100% triggered setup detection. You might want to just turn that feature off, because that's probably not going to work for you. So what do you do if something triggers setup detection, and it shouldn't, and it's wrong? And we can actually see that. So if we go into, you know, this, take a look at what it's trying to do. Stock viewer update orders. Ah, there's the heuristic. It can be in the string table too. There's various parts, and the shim database actually shows all of it. It's all there for you to read if you're really that interested. But I can go and take a peek at that and see what it is. I want it to stop prompting. So what I'm gonna do is go back, close this up, and edit this. And actually, I'm not going to hit this application. I'm going to make a new one for stock viewer order updater. stock viewer update orders.exe. And I don't want a whole mode, which is a mode, just a collection of shims kind of pre-packed together to make it easy, right? But we're experts here, so we can go to the good stuff. And we have a couple of different options. Right, these are the three run as shims: run as admin, run as highest, run as invoker. Run as admin says always prompt. Run as invoker says whoever. Right, it's don't prompt, don't elevate me. If I'm already elevated, it will not bring it back down to standard user. But it also won't go up. So invoker says whatever you are is fine. And then run as highest says, hey, if you are you have a split token, right? So you have an administrator token and filtered and unfiltered. Give me the unfiltered one. So this means it's going to prompt for administrators, but not prompt for standard users. Great example of this is MMC. Try running MMC as a standard user, no prompt. Run it as an admin, prompt. That's this configuration. I don't like it, right, because it kind of makes you feel like, I don't really know what's going to happen. I love things that are deterministic. But I get why the legacy software had to keep doing that without completely re-architecting it. So you got the three run as. And there's also specific installer and specific non-installer. You can use either one, right? You can use run as invoker, or you can use specific non-installer. They'll do the same thing. I like to tie it and say, if it's setup detection, I'm going to use specific non-installer so that I leave a flag to someone down the line saying, here's why I put it on. So you know what to take off and say, oh, okay, with setup detection, we can just fix that in another way if I'm running the software. Just a breadcrumb. So I'll do that one and say, yep, this is not an installer, right? It's a flag, so I don't need to put in any configuration. Save it, install it, and now when I go to launch it, it'll just open straight away and I've made the prompt go away. That's another important one to know. And the last one, all right, this has another bug that, again, that I didn't think had anything that was tended to be reusable by you. Last one, I'm going to save preferences. And you'll notice kind of what's happening here. This is sort of a strange zoom it bug. I'm trying to figure out how to. Nope. All right. Well, I'll just kind of do it this way. There you go. I see on the bottom there. I just can't circle it. I actually found this. An application that was saving information into downloaded program files. Right, and it turns out that downloaded program files is a special case because it is all teed up for Internet Explorer to use it because that's who owns it. I don't know why you're putting stuff there, right? But file and registry virtualization doesn't happen to, they could have literally written anywhere else in Windows, it would have been auto-fixed. But for whatever reason, they picked one of IE's directories and sort of started jamming stuff in there, so it didn't get auto-fixed. And I point this out because this is also something that we have to use this shim when we don't get the autofixes in virtualization for software that doesn't put itself into directories that virtualization covers. So if I'm software that is so important that I can't sit under program files, I got to sit in the root of C, Oracle, then, you know, I don't get autofixed. So how do I fix those? So to fix those, I have, actually, let me trigger options, save preferences, and I'm going to copy and paste because I'm bad at typing and I will make a mistake. So here's the path I'm trying to write to. And I'm getting accesses denied because, you know what, it's in the Windows directory and I'm a standard user. So if I were going to try and fix that, let's go ahead and go back and edit this one. This is one of the two most powerful shims. It also is one of the hardest to use. Right, so fair warning, right? So we've got to do parameters. We've got to do our typical mscorwks.dll and clr.dll. We're kind of getting familiar with that by now. We're all great at fixing up managed code. But I also have to put in a command line. Correct file paths just says, all right, I will take something and replace it with something else. You tell me what you want. I'll inspect everything that's trying to hit the file APIs. And if you're a match, swap it out. Drop the other one in. So I can fix anything that has to do with the file write. Right, super powerful. So I can say, I want to go from stock viewer.ne and put it somewhere where the user can write. And I'll just put it in the user's app data. And I'll put it as a reference so it's not hard-coded to me as a user, but whoever happens to be the user. Stockviewer.ini and there. So I'll point out a couple of things as to why this ends up being tricky to use. Right? One thing is, typically in a path, if you had something that had spaces in it, you'd quote the path. correct file paths, you don't quote the path, you quote the pair of paths. So you'll need to put it around both ends rather than quote, semicolon, quote. It's quotes are on the outside and the semicolon in the middle. Semicolon separates the old with the new. Right, so that's syntax there. The other one is file APIs tend to be pretty hot, right? If I launch Procmon and I say, yeah, let's just take a look at what's going on, and I don't care about the registry or processes or anything else. You know, I just care about the file APIs. Boy, Mark has some perf issues. He needs to get busy. Come on. Yeah, you can kind of see it's climbing. These are hot APIs. This is every single call. We'll watch it just go, blah, blah, blah. Every single time you call a file API, you're going to be running code saying, are you this file? Nope, okay. Are you this one? Nope, okay. This one? Nope, okay. Thousands of times, potentially. There's a lot of file activity going on. So for perf reasons, we don't do any normalization to say, oh, let's maybe you put a short path, long path, all kinds of things like that. We don't do any of that. It's a literal string match. That's why it's very convenient that in Lua Buglight, we'll tell you the exact strings that got sent. So you can copy and paste what was fed to the API. Because if you don't string match, even if it technically means the same thing, we won't swap it. Otherwise, we're going to take too much time. We're going to slow down the app, have a big perf hit. Literal string match, quote the pairs. You get all that, you're gold. You also have a limit of max path in terms of how many characters, right? So there's only so many you can fix up. Right, so you've got some constraints that apply, but it's a very powerful option. So we're going to redirect this. Let's save it, install it. Now we're updated. I've got to relaunch our stock viewer. And now when I go to options, save preferences, now it works. Right, the two most commonly used ones for fixing standard user stuff, one of them is virtual registry. Right, we looked at the light one, virtualize HKCR light, and that's the one I use most often. And then correct file paths. And between those, you can fix just about everything. So I wanted to take a little tour. I know we spent a long time, but believe me, I think this is absolutely core and central. While you still have admins, all of the other controls you put in place can be turned off by the adversary. So it's a really valuable investment. Don't go for everybody, right? We started, it's got to be something that is we're going through cyclically and moving forward. Fixing all that we can, and getting rid of admin rights, not just for most software, but for all software. Can totally be done. But I get that it's hard, and we're here to help. If you have challenges, hard ones, reach out, right? I'm appcompatguy@microsoft.com, right? I'm not exactly hard to find. And we'll help get that sorted. So that's step one. The next step is get modern. Right? If there's one thing that I can say, what's the best way to stay secure? Get current, stay current. Number one thing with all the stuff you do. So I want to talk about that. Like, you know, there's all kinds of things that are good, right? I'm not clearly not a marketing guy. I show way too much assembly language on my screen to be a marketing guy. So I'm going to kind of talk about some of the cool stuff. But more importantly, I'm going to talk about how we see people getting there. Right, this is virtualization-based security. There's lots of information and features that are coming in there. It's all good stuff. Right? What do you do to get there? So when you think cyclically, here's one of the cycles, right? What do I build first? Well, a regular general purpose workstation. Let's start with that. Then look at, well, maybe I'm going to do an admin workstation. Maybe I'm going to do a scenario for my sensitive information workers, like the guy who's working with the IP that I know I've got nation states trying to get. Let me give them something that's even harder than that, more hardened than our standard one. Good idea, right? What about my kiosks? What can I do to make my kiosks as trusted as they can be? Obviously, they're out in the public, right? There's lots of things we can do differently. I have worked with scenarios, and I have seen some terrifying things in low-trust environments. You know, for example, I've seen point-of-sale systems running as local admin. You're like, really? Do you know how hard it is to get onto a point-of-sale system if you're an adversary and you want to plant something on there? It actually takes exactly two ingredients to get physical access to any point of sale system in the world that we've found so far. Two things. Number one, it takes a tie. Number two, it takes a short sleeve shirt. If you walk in there with a short sleeve shirt and a tie and say you're from the IT department, literally every single point of sale person that will, oh, yes, sir, here you go. Short sleeves work better. What do I do about low trust? Now, the administrative workstation, I want to talk about a case there because it really does go down to the workstation, and I think that's important. And I wanted to show you why by showing you the exploit that could happen. And I got a little bit of feedback that said, you know what, there are people who actually use the approach that you're going to do. It would be kind of nice if you didn't show a live exploit of the approach that they're using on stage. Like, it'd be good if you didn't do that. So I said, okay, great, I see the problem now. I asked permission. So I failed to ask permission over whether I could show a video of it, accidentally forgot, and wanted to kind of showcase what this is, because a lot of people say I can do my privilege access management by just having a VDI server that's super locked down, that's refreshed, and everything is fine. I can go and reach it from absolutely anywhere in the world, and it will all work just fine, right? Totally solves my problem. So now I can just carry on. My admins can be at home on their home PCs, untrusted, whatnot. Right? So what I've written to showcase why this might not be the world's best strategy, why you might want to extend that trust to the keyboard, is what if the adversary gets some code running on the device that you're connecting to it with? What if they are? Now, in this case, the adversary is not a very good adversary because he makes you click a button that says pwn in order to launch the attack. If you, by the way, see a button that's appear on your screen all of a sudden that says pwn, don't click it. Right? But all it's going to do is, once I've got this button clicked, you can do UI automation to that remote desktop window and start typing whatever the adversary wants to type, such as adding themselves in as a user on the system. Now, it's Mr. Badgy. And then adding that particular user to the local administrators group, and then even doing things like cleaning up. Like, oh, yeah, oh, you might notice this. So maybe I'll just hit CLS, and now, whoop, you don't even know what happened. But I've just put myself into the local admins group on my hardened VDI server because I accessed it somewhere other than from a hardened workstation. And adversaries, first of all, they are using this. This is the amount of code it took, by the way. 262 lines of unoptimized code. I could make it way shorter. There's a limit to how much I feel like I should be optimizing, you know, actual exploits, though. So I'm like, you know, I think I'll stop. I think that's good. So we start with them. It's, I can't just say, hey, hardened VDI is fine. It's like, no, I need to keep going because there still is an attack vector. We have seen people using it. They are using automation. Some of the clever things that we've seen are an adversary who will take a screenshot of the screen as it currently exists and set it to the foreground as an image in a window that's in the foreground while they go driving it through Windows messages in the background. So you can't see what they're doing. It just looks like Windows has hung. And of course, we're kind of used to Windows hanging every now and then. Right, so we're like, oh, Windows hung again. All right, I'll just wait and it'll clear up. And then it does. Right, in the interim, they've done something behind this full screen window. Right, I mean, they're doing clever stuff to do this automation. So I'm like, all right, you know what? We really need to get all the way to having a hardened workstation as an important part of our strategy. So think through the scenarios and think about how to get there. Right, how many of you are fully deployed on Windows 10 today? One, do you work at Microsoft, sir? Awesome. That is great news. Most people are kind of figuring out the plan right now, so I wanted to talk about a bit of the risks that we're seeing, right, and how people are getting there, right? Because what we see is, hey, we got programmed from how we did our migration from XP, right? That's the last one most people did, is the XP migration. I'm guessing that one kind of sucked for you. Is that a fair summary? Yeah, well, lots of heads nodding like, yeah, that kind of sucked, right? It was hard, right? Why was it hard? Because on average, we broke 21% of your stuff. So one out of five pieces of software you had to do something with. Windows 7 to Windows 10 or Windows 8 to Windows 10 don't look like that at all. Right, statistically speaking, and I'll caveat this, these are early adopters. If you fully deployed Windows 10 today, you are still in the early adopter category. Early adopters tend to behave different not only in their OS, but in the software they run on their OS. They tend to be more current overall, statistically speaking. Right, so it's a little bit different, but the failure rates we're seeing so far coming from Windows 7, versus Windows 8, right? Windows 7, it's about a 2% failure rate. And Windows 8 or 8.1, it is a fraction of a percent failure rate. The difference between the two of them is, starting in Windows 8.1, we observed, hey, you know what the big, the final last mile is? I can actually show you the last mile problem. The last mile problem is that. Oh, I really wish you were there, right? And here's, and I have seen the craziest things happen, right? Oh, I'm going to fix that. You know, and you know how they fix that? I once watched someone type. How many of you are familiar with the MSI database format? Kind of seen it before? So this will sound kind of familiar to those of you, right? There's a launch condition, right? And the launch condition was if version NT equals 400 or version NT equals 500 or version NT equals 501 or version NT equals 502, got them through 2003. And they fixed it for Win 7 by saying or version NT equals 600 or version NT. And I'm like, really? Does your keyboard not have a greater than key? Because it seems like that'd make it a lot easier. Or maybe you don't have to ask. Because every time you ask, you're basically saying, if it's an internal app, I don't think those IT guys can do their jobs. They said they're going to deploy Win 7. I don't trust them. They're probably going to throw some XP out there for some reason. So let's check every single time you launch the application. Right? My favorite, there was a web application commercially available. The guilty will not be named here. The web application checked to see whether you were running Internet Explorer 6 on every single page. And popped up a warning, let you use it. It was just like every page you went to, hey, you're not using i6. Okay. Next page, hey, you're still not using i6. Okay, next page. Hey, literally every page. That's what they're doing. And it turns out, I just wanted to show you how you can fix that real quick. So that's actually launching an executable. So I'm going to call it the star button. On this program files, stock viewer. And that's got the world's worst name for an application ever. Right, but it's WinXP SP2. You apply a version like shim. Hey, tell it you're this version of Windows. Another pure flat-out lie. Hey, what version of Windows are you? MXP. Oh, okay, cool. Everything's great then. All right, so let's save it, install it, and now we're going to launch it. And it'll show you a star. The world's greatest function. Like I said, you don't download this because you really want to be productive, but to showcase that. But it's important to know how to do that because it turns out that's the difference between 7 and 8. Starting in Windows 8.1, we said, you know what? Why do you have to do that every time? Right? If people are going to keep writing these silly checks, why do you have to still go find every single one and apply a shim to it and say, really, can you guys update it to at least Windows 10, blah, blah, blah. So we said, you know what? Forget that. We just lie by default now. Hey, what version of Windows are you? You know, Windows 8.1 will say, I'm 8.0. Go ask Windows 10, hey, what version of Windows are you? I'm 8.0. And we just don't tell the truth. Now, if you put in an application manifest with a compatibility section saying, yep, I know all about Windows 10, I'm cool, right? You can tell me the truth, we'll tell you the truth. Until you do, you get lied to by default, and that was the final mile, and now we're looking at fractions of a percentage failure rate. So cleaning up your Windows 7, do your version lies, clean all that up, and then we can move forward. With a profile like this, right, suddenly you're looking at, hey, 20%, 2%, fraction of a percent, that looks more like another update process that I'm already pretty familiar with. Windows updates. Right? Windows updates don't break a whole lot of stuff, right? But I'm sure you'll agree, sometimes some things break. It happens. I do that every month. I have more practice doing that than I do big XP migration projects. I know how to do low failure rates, right? Typical process is, yep, you know what? Day one, we'll deploy it to the team. Day two, we'll deploy it to the floor. Day three, the rest of the floors in the building. Day four, all the buildings in the complex. Day five, all the things in the state. Day six, rest of the country. Day seven, rest of the world. I have a process to do that, kind of catch things along the way. Can I use a process more like that? When I think about managing risk, think about the actual risk that the applications pose themselves. This is an eyeful slide. This is really intended for download and read. And this, the whole concept here, my latest blog post, which is about 387 pages long, so apologies for the length, actually goes into all of this levels of detail, talking about how do we start categorizing it based on what's going to happen. How critical is the risk to the software? What downtime can I sustain? And really distributing it, right? Because if you ask an actual application owner, which of these are mission critical? We actually did some measurements. It turns out that 70% of applications are mission critical. It also turns out that in a well-managed environment, we find an average of 2,500 applications in an enterprise. And in a typically managed environment, it's more like 30,000. So if 70% of your 30,000 applications are actually mission critical and posing high risk, you have a lot of risk. But you probably are overestimating how many are actually mission critical. About 2% is what, like, hey, these 2% can't fail, right? High risk, medium risk, low risk. Really think about how do I figure out what's going to cause me a problem so I know to look at the right stuff, right? And then build out the right way to do my testing with a series of testing approaches. And that distribution will depend on where I'm coming from, right? Whether I'm coming from XP or Win7, I would just balance them differently to say I'm going to do more and more reactive testing, which is like wait for you to call me and then I'll fix it, versus do it in the pilot, versus hey, poke around it for a little while, versus do a full end-to-end regression. Shift them around as part of the process to help be more current. Or if we start to develop more agile approaches, it helps us to get some quick wins, get some scenarios. I love the approach that was used actually for the Vista migration from the now sort of absorbed into United Continental Airlines. It's a great approach. I love their case study because they said, you know, we're going to start with our gate agents. You got to go up to the gate and they kind of check you in, move seats around, right? They have like 10 pieces of software, and if any of them ever go down, they just hop on the phone and still take care of the exact same thing with almost no loss of productivity, very low risk. And they were able to deploy thousands of seats, report in, and management was like, hooray, seats went out. And they went to the gate readers, and they went to the call centers, and they went to all the structured task workers. By that time they got to information workers, they knew how to do this stuff. Iterate, sprints, get things out there, and think about how do I get onto various rings, right, within Windows 10 to think about Windows as a service and so forth, so I can move forward. And this is just Windows. Be also mindful of the rest of the application stack that you've got. For example, how many of you can honestly say that every single endpoint device inside of your organization or company is running only the very latest version of Java? There are 3 hands up in the room. So congratulations, that is quite a feat. Those of you who didn't raise your hands, how many of you knew this? There will be no more Java applets supported by Oracle started in Java 9. I know, and there was much rejoicing except for, oh, all my stuff I'm going to have to run anyway. So I'm going to have to keep Java 8 up and running for that. Ooh, am I going to have to buy custom support? Right? This is the challenge of staying up to date. It's not just Windows. It's the whole stack. So get current, stay current. What about hardening it? Right, think about hardening the OS, right? And when I look at hardening the OS, right, there's a lot of features that come in the OS that can help protect me. I'm a lot less interested in features. I think it's really important to be standardized and to use stuff that is known and trusted. In fact, one of my favorite blog posts ever, I'm going to sticking with well-known, oh, look, there we go. Boom, my favorite blog post ever on the concept of not creating bespoke things. You know, which has comments like this. You know, if the guy who manages your app deployment gets hit by a truck, you'll probably go out of business. Does that describe you, right? these bespoke solutions are hurting agility. So we published baseline. This is the most current security baseline, which is for Windows 10, 15, 11. So if you want to implement a high security configuration, well, number one, you don't have a high security need. The defaults are actually better than a lot of organizational defaults that have been evolving over time. Like I have seen, hey, here's my hardened IE6 policy that I'm still using today in IE11. And you're like, wow, that's actually way worse than the defaults. Because IE6 was kind of barn doors wide open. You closed one barn door. We ship it with both barn doors closed and a few locks on it. And you're loosening it back up again because of legacy configurations. Default can be good for a lot of scenarios. And we ship these. You can go in and see the full documentation and say, yep, here's all the things that we recommend. And the value of sticking with this known and proven solution is this is being run on millions and millions of devices already. So we know what happens. There are consequences of not knowing what happens. The unintended consequences of security lockdowns are many. One of my favorites was working with a government agency in another country that had copied the what at the time was called the Federal Desktop Core Configuration. Today it's USGCB. It uses these baselines as their foundation. They copied it. But they hadn't kept their copies in sync. So it was the copy as of the date while it was still in development that they built it. And they said, all right, we're going to use this. They had this configuration. That configuration had something we were experimenting with, which was let's remove everyone from the SE debug privilege. SE debug, incidentally, you do not need in order to debug software. SE debug allows you to get into any other process on the system without an access check. So like, oh, well, we shouldn't need that. Let's take that away from everybody, including local system. No one's in it. It's empty. So you think, what's the unintended consequence of that? Well, who would have thought that every single commercially available database available at that time took the SE debug privilege as part of its installation routine? You could not install with that configuration a new instance of SQL Server, Oracle, DB2, MySQL, or any other database in the world with that configuration. That's the kind of stuff, you're like, you know, I'd like you to know that, you know, hey, you can actually install new databases. Right? The existing ones were fine, right? It didn't break all existing databases, they just couldn't install any new instances. That's the kind of thing to avoid. You know, I've looked at, you know, various different subsets of policies. I'm actually going to just take an IE policy and look at, where's IE? Here we go. This is the number of different permutations of group policies in Internet Explorer itself. That's it, not the rest of Windows. So if you go through one by one and think, what's the best policy, right? Because I do see people, they get the group policy list. And if you've seen the movie The Jerk starring Steve Martin, it's like, the new phone books are here, the new phone books are here. It's like, the new group policies are here, the new group policies are here. Let me go see which one of these configurations I can build. To give you a sense of scale, this is the number of atoms in the observable universe. So it's kind of a big number. So sticking with the known and proven solution as your baseline, turning on features, planning for the images, understanding what the compatibility impact so you can come out and really take advantage of the platform, lock it down, and begin to have that hardened baseline. To then move into hardening the software that's running on it, right? Taking the SDL process or software development lifecycle, or security development lifecycle, sorry, that teaches how do we make secure software in the first place, right? Threat modeling, if there's one and only one thing you're going to learn from that tool set, you're in threat modeling. You can use it for infrastructure, for software, for everything. Super, super helpful for learning how to build better software, understanding what the risks are so you don't end up building the next SUV that can be remotely controlled and exploitable while running on the highway in St. Louis. Right, because there are very, very real risks from doing that. Build more secure software. And then we start getting into further lockdown. So I'm going to take lockdown in two steps, and I'm going to introduce one concept that we found to be really powerful. It's really difficult to get to a point of whitelisting all of my devices to say only this software can run on this device. That's hard. If I can't do that right now, I can start by blacklisting user writable areas. You downloaded random thing from the internet, it's not going to run. If it got dropped into program files, the assumption is an administrator did that. See bullet number one, you're not a local admin anymore. The admin did it, that's okay. So we can go through and we have a process where we can automate and say, all right, these are all of the directories where you've actually loosened the ACLs to allow things to done, to write to it. So we'll blacklist those, otherwise we'll whitelist the Windows directory and program files. That's okay, because admins put stuff there, and the rest will be blacklisted. So now you've blocked your users from having user-written stuff. So if they go out and they grab arbitrary executable, it's not going to run. Admin puts something down, it does. So you don't have to know everything. You've now just said, hey, if the admin didn't put it there, it's not going to work. A really great first step is something we worked on in partnership with the NSA to get to that point, right? Super powerful. To then move on to the next step, where it makes sense, a proper whitelist, right? Because we came from a world in which we trusted everything. Until we get a signature, it's all good. The whole world is full of nothing but good software. Turns out that may not actually be true, right? We can't just detect all of the bad software, right? Software should earn its trust, not be given it by default. There's too much bad stuff going on out there, right? And that's where we look at how do we implement that. We have, I mean, this has been evolving over time. Not only has it been evolving, but in typical Microsoft style, we rename it every time just so you don't really know what it is. Software restriction policies became App Locker, which is honestly a pretty good name, which now sits side by side with Device Guard. They are complementary. There are things you can do in App Locker that you can't do in Device Guard, and vice versa, obviously, right? Device Guard adds some really powerful isolation across the virtualization boundary. It helps me protect that. But now I can really lock it down and say, these are only the apps that are going to do, and if I get really good at digitally signing my stuff, then I can get some really good assurances that are hardware-backed. That's the caveat. How many organizations digitally sign every piece of software they build internally? Right? A couple. There certainly are some, but for most people, it's not a competency. PKI digital signatures are an important part of an all-up strategy because it helps to ensure that we have not tampered with everything, and it also ties in there, right? The one complaint that we would hear from folks with AppLocker was it's not configurable enough for my software. So it turns out AppLocker works really, really well with your signed stuff, but the hash rules with your unsigned stuff are hard to keep up to date, right? To which our answer is, well, you really should be signing stuff, right? There are other tools that will do a better job of handling it, but from a security perspective, getting more and more stuff signed is going to leave you better off. So then I can really start taking advantage and getting Device Guard put into place. And now I'm starting to build up some really good defenses. I have standard users. I have a modern OS. I've hardened it using known and proven solutions. I've hardened my software. I'm now only letting admin-written stuff run or only letting specifically approved stuff run. And then finally, well, let's make sure that I have some good response to compromise, right? Because this is sort of an important one that we're seeing more and more lately because of the shift in adversary tactics. It used to be the primary tactic they would use is get into your system, stay quiet, steal all your stuff, blah, 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 shove all stuff off here, and maybe you'll notice it going out eventually. On average, we see the time to detection being on the order of 260 days. In Europe, it's over 400 days. Now we're seeing, hey, you know what? The value of this stuff is kind of going down. You know, if you live in the United States, there are about 300 million Social Security numbers. 200 million of them have already been stolen. So the incremental value of each additional one is pretty low. So I can't sell it for as much. So if, hey, you know, if I'm not going to get 10 bucks for this, I know what I'll do. I'll just encrypt all your files and put a thing saying, hey, can you give me 10 bucks, please? How do I respond to that? And we're starting to see this kind of threat more and more. How do I respond to that, right? Do I have to pay them to get that back? Or do I have a more robust response for being able to come back with that, right? Because from a holistic response, part of that is I need to be able to do a scorched earth. So I know, yes, with Windows 10, you can do an upgrade install, So you don't need to really technically do OS deployment anymore, right? And I'll say, no, you still do. Because if you get an endpoint, you're like, I don't trust that endpoint anymore. You know what I would do? Scorched earth. I would have my data in the cloud. I would have my apps automatically drop down. I'd have my OS easily deployable. Say, yep, nope, you know what? I don't trust that. Fry it, raise it, down to the ground, back to the metal, back up again. Apps come down, data comes down, and I'm back, and I'm good again. Because that's how I sterilize the endpoint. Robust. This works well for server. Turns out that's actually really, really hard to do for Active Directory, right? If your Active Directory kind of gets polluted, someone gets domain admin, right? Scorched earth is hard. Everyone's like, understatement there, right? Scorched earth is an 18-month painful project, right, in many, many cases. But in the endpoint, it should be easy. So how do I recover from that, make that really easy? How do I help make sure that I'm doing as much to block it? That's what we've been talking about so far. How do we contain they can't get any further, right? This is a really important challenge. When we look at some of the things that we've seen in some of the ransomware stories lately, we had one ransomware incident where the adversary actually got to domain admin rights before deploying it and used group policy to distribute ransomware. Needless to say, that kind of sucked. That was not a happy day. Although it worked beautifully, the entire system deployed things very quickly. It was a well-managed software distribution system. So we want to make sure they don't get that. That's important, right? So protecting privileged access, as we kind of talked about in one of the case scenarios on the endpoint, really important. That would have helped them there. What else, right? I'm dealing with another customer who had a bit of a ransomware problem. And it wasn't that they ever were able to gain lateral traversal. Gaining one account did not gain them other accounts. Actually had pretty good hygiene there. The problem they had was they had a bunch of directories that granted all users in the organization right access. And we've had this at Microsoft. We used to have a directory that's like, yeah, here's just a share, just put whatever you want to. It's temporary. Every now and then we kind of raise it down, but it's yours. And ransomware could get in there and encrypt the whole thing. And that was their challenge. They had a lot of directories that other people may have been using, and it was granting access to everybody. So minimize that so that now it's just the one person, and then obviously have the ability to restore from backup. Because this is kind of the challenge, right? And it's something that's gotten me thinking as well, because what did I use as a backup? And I have two forms of backup. Neither of them are offline. I back up to the cloud, and I back up to a secondary hard drive in the same machine. It's like, oh, so any ransomware running as me can get to both of those. Right? So I've got to figure out another strategy to periodically put pictures and stuff on there so that I can do that. And an enterprise, same thing. What's my offline story? How often do I go? So based on the amount of risk I can tolerate for that person to bring it offline so I can have a better response. But that's the roadmap. And then wash, rinse, repeat. Go to the next scenario and walk your way around the list. Right? Let's not do everyone at first. Let's get started off here. We'll get your standard users. Then we'll start getting you on a modern OS. And then we'll harden it down. We'll get the right configuration for your scenario. Then we're going to start figuring out how do we get to whitelisting, blacklisting, where does that fit? Right? Do we have good backups? All right, grab next group and just keep going. It's sort of like when they talk about the Sydney Harbor Bridge in Sydney that overlooks the air. And they're like, you know, by the time they finish painting the bridge, it's time to start painting it again. They're always painting the bridge. Right, same thing here. Just kind of keep moving, right? And now this becomes business as usual, much less effort, because now I'm just kind of going. It's part of my business as usual routine. I never lose the muscles, right? I don't have the hey, it's been 10 years, time for new OS. How we do that last time, right? Because it's really important to make this cyclical, right? Because interestingly, what is the single greatest predictor of whether an application is going to fail on a new build of Windows? Whether it failed last time, right? So if I do a process of find it all, fix it all, and throw the list away, I've lost the most important piece of information I have. Instead, keep the information there and keep going, and now my behavior is I'm just going to do nothing but keep making the organization better, more modern, more productive, and more secure. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the show.